Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary together. Today is Monday, May 6th, and today is former Representative Lane Shutterly Day. So, Lane, if you'd like to come on up, and Wendy, we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2833A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2833A adopts the Unsworn Foreign Declarations Act, provides consistency with the current Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, allowing declarations. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. Lane Shutterly, for the record, here on this bill as chair of the Oregon Law Commission and also as a Uniform Law Commissioner. This bill comes from the Uniform Law Commission. It's very simple. We have in the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure a provision that allows for when an affidavit, a sworn statement is required in the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, there is a process that allows an unsworn declaration to be used instead of an affidavit if an affidavit can't be obtained for one reason or another. That only applies to the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. There are other provisions in state law where affidavits may be required and can't be obtained. For instance, it's most common if someone is out of the country, their challenge is to have to find a foreign embassy or a U.S. embassy. Find a notary there and have an affidavit made. This bill brings state law other than the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure into harmony with the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure and allows for an unsworn declaration to be made in lieu of an affidavit where the law otherwise requires an affidavit with certain exceptions that are stated in the bill. It's a very simple bill. There's no opposition in the House, and I urge your support for it.
Thank you. Wendy?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Oregon Law Commission. The only thing I would add is that it creates this new provision to allow for unsworn declarations, but it also tweaks the perjury statutes because sworn statements are subject to perjury, and we needed to include these unsworn statements that you sign subject to perjury. We need to include that within the perjury definition. It doesn't create a fiscal or anything. It's just using a different method, but you will see that the perjury statute is amended. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And Mr. Chair, you do have the report of the Oregon Law Commission with the in the record of the committee.
Yeah, we do have that. Thank you for pointing that out.
Yep.
All right. Any questions? No questions. Is there anyone else who wants to testify today on House Bill 2833A? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing, opening a work session on House Bill 2833A. Senator Dingfelder.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2833A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 2833A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Chair will carry these next three since they're commission bills. And we'll close the work session on 2833A, open a public hearing on 2834.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2834 adopts a revised uniform law on notarial acts as Oregon law. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Lane.
Mr. Chair, Lane Shatterly again for the record here on behalf of the Oregon Law Commission and the Uniform Law Commission. As Anna said, this adopts the revised Uniform Law on Notarial Acts, which was last adopted. Well, the Uniform Act, I think, was adopted 82. In 1982. It's been updated for a number of reasons, I think driven primarily by technology, recognizing that notarial acts today involve technology more than they do in ways than in 1982. So that was what was driving the update of the act. There are some other provisions in it. I'll let Wendy walk you through the bill. Tom Rosch is also here from the Secretary of State's office. And if I may, I'll just invite him up. I think Tom is going to speak on behalf of this bill, too. But this has been through a work group process at the Oregon Law Commission to harmonize it with other provisions of Oregon law and, in some places, our current notarial statutes. And if I may, I'll just turn it over to Wendy for the play-by-play.
Senator Brzezinski, members of the committee, again, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Law Commission, for the record. You do have a pretty lengthy report. This bill is over 60 sections long. Because we're actually doing a gut and stuff of the existing notary chapter. We had a portion of the Uniform Act, and then we had some of our own provisions. We've now taken the whole new Uniform Act and folded in those provisions we wanted to keep that were unique to Oregon, that were good policy provisions, but we've made the process consistent with the other states, and it now reads like a complete chapter instead of this mishmash. So it is a total rewrite. The work group membership is listed on page 2 of the report. It was a pretty big work group. The clerk, county clerks were particularly interested in this area because they do these notarizations all the time. So this is fun to have people from Curry County and Crook County on the work group for some diversity there. The project was requested by the Secretary of State's office. They're the ones who certify notaries and provide the exams and all that. So it was requested by Secretary of State Brown, and Tom Rosh from that office participated on the work group. As Commissioner Sutterly explained, we've had the Uniform Act in Oregon for a long time, and it goes back to 1982, but we haven't done an update. There are substantive changes that actually make it easier for people to get something notarized, and those are probably the biggest policy changes. And the list of people that can do these notary acts was not consistent in Oregon law. I noticed we have Carl Myers behind us. It wasn't clear about the muni judges and the justice of the peace and all that, who could do notarizations. And so this act does change the definitions for the list of officials. It just was vague before. We can keep a lot of Oregon unique provisions, like we don't allow embossment alone. You have to do it with the stamp because it doesn't photocopy very well, and the clerks don't like that. And so we don't follow the Uniform Act on everything. But we did make a lot of substantive changes to follow the uniform provisions. We codified a conflict of interest rule that we did not have before. And it basically, if you have a direct beneficial interest in what's being notarized, you can't be the notary. That had been the suggestion from the Secretary of State's office, and it was in all their training materials, but it wasn't actually in statute, so we codified that. The basic requirements to conduct a notary are the same. We did add a presence requirement that you have to be in front of the notary. It wasn't actually in statute, but that, again, had been practiced and is what's expected, but it actually wasn't listed. Another important change is that we do now allow expired IDs to be used to verify the person up to 3 years. We're not saying that the expired driver's license actually can be used to drive, but it's you're just verifying that the person on that driver's license is the person before you. And as you know, people in nursing homes or in hospitals and such oftentimes don't have a new ID yet. And it's actually been a constituent issue for some people that it's quite a hassle to get identification. And that, again, comes from the Uniform Act's recommendation.
So, Wendy, you said for 3 years?
Senator Prusansky, members of the committee, yes, 3 years, up to 3 years. Another change is the credible witness provision. If you don't have an identification, you can use a witness who knows who you are. The prior law was that the notary, the credible witness had to know the notary. And again, the same problem, if someone's been institutionalized for a long time, there may not be anybody in that who actually knows the person and knows the notary. And so the new law allows, as long as that credible witness knows the person that they're doing the notarization for, and they have identification that's proper, then it can be done. There was no detail of what the identification actually had to be for Oregon, and the work group felt the most important parts of that identification are the signature and a photo, and so we've put that in the statute. We do continue to allow military IDs and driver's license and those types. The ID list is still the same, but some of them were just vague on what had to be in them, tribal identification and such, but they at least have to have a signature and a photo. We codify the existing law, which allows you to refuse to provide a notarization for someone as long as it doesn't violate other law, which primarily would be civil rights law. But that's put in the statute rather than just in the rules. Another provision, which is in Section 8, is that we will allow proxies. This is a real problem with somebody who has a broken arm or something and literally can't sign. We continue to allow a signature with just an X or whatever their signature or stamp might be, but sometimes that's not even possible. So this bill would allow for a proxy. Sections 10 through 13 of the bill have to do with recognizing other jurisdictions, other states, federally recognized Indian tribes, and federal authorities. So we continue those provisions. Let's see. We continue to allow corrections. There's the certificate that you do when the notary does, and sometimes a mistake is done on that certificate, and we continue to allow those corrections to be made after the fact. We talked a lot about whether we should put a color change, have a different color for the stamp, and the work group decided to leave that area alone, but just to require that the stamp be legible. One of the biggest headaches for the Secretary of State's office is handling all of the journals and stamps that are returned to them when a notary dies or resigns or their notary is revoked. So we redid all of that, and the short of it is that if you're just not renewing and such, you don't have to send that material in. But if your notary is revoked, you do need to send both the stamp and the journal in. So it's going to cut down on the things that the Secretary of State has to box and store. If the notary dies, the personal representative will continue to be required to remit the journal back, so that if there's a question later, that there is still that record. The hope is that in the next few years that the journal will become electronic so that we don't have to have all this submitting it back and such, but we're not quite there. But software companies definitely are busy trying to get electronic journals. And it's for 10 years that you need to keep your journal if you resign or your term expires. Oregon's had a number of exceptions to the journaling requirement, mostly those requested by lawyers and law firms, and we continue those same exceptions. So, for example, you don't have to journal oaths, you don't have to journal protests of commercial paper and such. Let's see. We did not require a citizenship requirement because more recent case law that says that that's an equal protection problem, so we did not codify that requirement. And we got rid of the adjacent state issue because we have people that practice in Oregon that aren't in the adjacent state, and so that's the new requirement of whether you have a place of business in Oregon. We revised the list of crimes and made it clear which ones would make you ineligible for getting a notary, and just made that consistent. We do not require a bond. Oregon has long not required a bond, and the Uniform Act does, but the work group saw no need really to go down that route. We continue to have a four-year term and have an exam requirement to get a notary if it's new. And we've reorganized the grounds for denial, revocation, and suspension. A lot of those materials came from existing rules. The Secretary of State's office will keep an online database of the notaries, so you can check to see who's available. And then in Section 24, we list the prohibited acts, and we have beefed up the abuse of notaries. In the Spanish language, it's called notarios, and you may have seen some work that the Department of Justice has done in that area. It was even in the news. We beef those up and make it clear what prohibitions there are, but give new tools for the Department of Justice to enforce for the Secretary of State's office. In the area of tax and immigration, there's notarios are known for portraying that they are tax official or be able to do tax preparations and do immigration law instead of just notarizing materials. And so those acts are prohibited and allows better tools to enforce and stop that abuse. For example, a new provision is that a notary may not withhold records. That was a case that happened recently, and the Uniform Act prohibits that as well, that if you're a notary, you can't hang on to a person's records, basically holding them hostage and such, that would be prohibited and would be subject to penalties. We continue the rulemaking authority for the Secretary of State's office, provide that the maximum fee that you can charge is $40 to do the notary, and I think the rest are pretty much just all cleanup. We did put a six-year statute of limitations for the violations. There was no statute of limitations, so we put one in. That's the standard default generally in Oregon anyway. It does have an early start date of September 1st for parts of the bill at the request of the Secretary of State's office because they're ready to roll out new materials and such and are wanting this to get done. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Tom. We take your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Prasansky. Members of the committee, my name is Tom Roush. I'm the Commercial Registry Manager for the Corporation Division of Secretary of State's Office. And I thank you for the chance of being here today and listening to this bill. This bill is important to the Secretaries of State. The National Association of Secretaries of State has supported this, the uniform law, and has made it a goal to get this enacted, to promote uniform laws throughout the country. It is not uniform in any way, shape, or form today. So Oregon will be taking the step of adopting more uniform language. We were one of the Uniform Law on Notarial Act states. So we're now doing the revision, and we're very happy to see that. That's all I wanted to say. We were a member of the task force. We think this is a really good bill, and we urge your support. Thank you very much.
Senator Close first, and Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions. Wendy, you said that you had added people that could do this, but had there been any removed that are no longer qualified to be notaries?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Close, members of the committee, I don't believe there are any that were removed. It was more of clarifying which judges, because judge often is just focused on circuit court, and there are other local judges that we were particularly wanting to include. And then we were adding more clerks as the counties have changed how they're structured. Clerks originally did have notarial authority, but they do not now, all of them, depending on how that organization is, and I'm not the county expert, but I know you have to get specific language to catch how those courts are now managed in some counties, and so we've added rather than subtracted.
Okay. Follow-up?
Mm-hmm.
Wendy, you said that in the Uniform Act they require a bond. You decided not to. Can you tell me what your thinking was on that?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Close, members of the committee, the bond requirement, our experience is that what you care most about is when you're talking about a very expensive deal that you're notarizing that action. The bond, even if you set it, you know, even relatively high, it's not going to provide any help in those situations. Instead, it's going to provide a barrier to the run-of-the-mill notary at the county and the wherever else. They're now going to have to pay this bond requirement for everything, and it's just more expensive and a burden. The reason, actually, for your previous question of why we added those other state officials is that there are parts of the county that it's very difficult to find a notary, and the counties need at least somebody who's available, and that's why we have a designee that's permitted in some so that some counties can designate. If the clerk isn't there, they can designate to somebody else, because there has been a problem of not having anyone who's able to do an oath or to notarize.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your excellent work. By the way, when you have time to take on environmental statutes, I'm definitely interested to hear, because the work that I've observed over the years I've been here at the Law Commission is really tremendous, and we're fortunate to have the staff that we do. Question I have is what's the mechanism for training notaries about these changes? So, in other words, when we have new notaries, I'm assuming, you know, this will be in practice, so they'll be trained. But I'm thinking we must have, thousands of notaries around the state at this point? So how do we train existing notaries? Because you're talking about practices that have probably been in place for many years, and I was thinking about, you know, how do we get the word out, or are we going to be requiring training? Do they have to come back and get regular training in order to keep up their certification?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Dingfelder, We actually have quite an extensive training program, and that's actually something that's very much on our minds. Is if this bill passes, that's obviously going to be a large training issue. Now, we have many avenues for training. One really quick thing is we have a listserv that we're encouraging notaries to, and have been for years, to sign up for, to get a list of all the new things that are coming out. We have a tutorial, online tutorial that we've recently, this year, upgraded, and of course it's with the current law now, but it will be updated to have the new law provisions taking place, whatever's changed. And certainly that's free, that's available to anybody at any time that they want to do it. It's 24/7 convenience. Up to you as a notary. You are required to take that training if you're already commissioned as a notary, but we'll certainly encourage people to do that. We also have face-to-face seminars that we go all throughout the state, and we're planning to really beef those up as soon as this statute comes into place, to really let folks know. We're working in partnership with a number of vendors who are education vendors certified with the state that are also going to be letting their folks know. People who have already signed up with them, people who are going to sign up with them, they're all going to get that education and that training. Obviously, on our website, we'll be alerting people. We'll be letting people know. I mean, we will let everybody know as much as we possibly can that there are new laws, and they have to, if they're not commissioned already, if they expire, their commission expires, they are required by this law to get education. So sometimes that irritates people who were commissioned as notaries and then let it expire, but it's a way to get people up to date. And certainly every 4 years as their commission comes up, that's something we really stress is to get the new education. We have about 39,000 notaries in this state. The number is actually fewer than it was pre-recession, but it's still a significant number, and we find it's very, very important to us to get the word out and make sure that they're trained.
So just a quick follow-up, so if I may. So all of the notaries have to be registered or certified by the Secretary of State, correct?
That's
and
correct.
Does the certification, it expires, did I hear, every 4 years? So wouldn't they just be required to go through this tutorial to update them before they can get recertified? I mean, it just makes total sense to me, because you're talking about some major change in practices from what's taken place in the past.
Senator Prezansky's, Chairman Prezansky, Senator Dingfelder, I would agree with you. Oregon has actually one of the most progressive education laws for notaries in the country. We're one of the few states that require education. That is not part of the law right now, or even in the bill, to have renewing notaries get education, only if you are not currently commissioned. That is something that we would love to see, but it isn't anything that is in the law right now.
That makes sense to me. I'm not suggesting it be in this bill, but anyway.
We're going to find out in a second. Anything else? Senator Oberlin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I look it over and I listen to the explanation, and I don't see major, major changes. I see most of them as codifying what the Secretary of State was already doing. So the training over the last period of time has basically said, this is what we think you should do, i.e., you're not, if you have a fiduciary interest in this deal, you shouldn't be a notary. But you've been saying that. If you did XYZ, we really recommend it this way, even though the law doesn't say that. So for me, as I look through the stuff and as I listen to the explanations, I'm hearing a lot of codifying practices that we've already been trying to implant, but now they are the law, so that the training isn't going to be that extensive for people, though the people that I know who are notaries look at the stuff all the time because they don't want to make a mistake. I mean, that, right. if there's one thing that every notary I've ever met understands, is they can lose their license fairly quickly if they are found to have done something incorrect. So they are pretty careful about it. The issue about being in person, I don't know any of us that don't do that, even though it was kind of surprising the law didn't require it. So, I mean, they take this very seriously, being a notary, in every instance that I've seen. And so I tend to see this more as making sure that we keep up to date with the kinds of things we've already been interested in.
Mr. Chair, yes, Senator, I think it's a good point that there aren't a lot of new traps in this for notaries. It does codify, as Wendy said, several things that they're being trained on as best practice. And also a good part of it that Wendy did not touch on is the electronic aspect of this, that notaries who are interested in using electronic processes will want to get up to speed on, not as a matter that they have to, but now it authorizes certain things that they're not able to do now. So it's a good point. There aren't a lot of new trips and traps here that notaries are going to get caught up on. Most of it really facilitates what they're doing.
Okay, and the chair wanted the clarification, Wendy. I think I was hearing you say that regarding statute of limitations, it was for 4 years. And can we just put on the record, if it was statute of limitations, are we talking about some type of act that was caused by the notary and that the person would have a cause of action up to 4 years?
Chair Pazinski, members of the committee, it's a four-year term for the notary, but it's a six-year statute of limitations for violations of the act.
Okay.
And that's in Section 44 of the act. The Department of Justice participated on this work group, and that's the number they recommended. And as I said, we worked to provide better authority for the Department of Justice to work with the Secretary of State's Office on Enforcement. There's often an overlap with unlawful practice of law, too. So providing consistent remedies was what they desired as well in this area. But it's a six-year statute of limitations.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. Any other questions or comments? Is there anyone else who wants to testify today on House Bill 2834? Not seeing, we'll close the public hearing, opening a work session. Senator Dingfelder.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2834 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 2834 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. As I said previously, Chair will carry this bill as a commissioner. And we'll close the work session on 2834, and we're going to open up our last of the commission bills for today, House Bill 2944.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2944 is not technically from the Oregon Law Commission, and I'm sure Mr. Shetterly will explain that. It's enacts the Uniform Electronic Legal Materials Act, provides process for designating electronic legal materials as official record, designates official publishers for Oregon Constitution, session laws, Oregon revised statutes, and Oregon administrative rules, requires publishers to ensure integrity, provide for backup, and continued usability of legal material, declares emergency effective on passage. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's kind of like the parent organization without being the parent of the Oregon Law Commission, from my perspective, because many of the things we do does come out of we do take in as Uniform Law Commission. Yeah. But he'll put his other hat on for this moment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lane Shetterly, for the record. Actually, what I'll do is just take off one of my hats, which
yes.
is the Oregon Law Commission. I'm glad I'm here. I don't see any of the House sponsors here for this bill. They must have known. I have to confess a little embarrassment here. As you know, typically, I try and catch topical and timely Uniform Law Commission laws and try to route them through the Oregon Law Commission so that we have a chance to kind of Oregonize them to bring forward to you, just as the last two bills that you saw. This one I had sort of put on the list for next session until this session, when I found out that a number of representatives in the House had taken it upon themselves to introduce this straight from the Uniform Law Commission. I was pleased, but I had to play a little bit of catch up. I asked them at one point how they came across this bill. And I can't remember which one of them said that they were just kind of scouring around looking for the most geeky bill that they could find, and this was this suited the criteria, and so they introduced this on their own. But it's a great bill, a pretty simple bill, but it will become more important in the future as we move more and more into the digital world. I've passed out testimony from Nicole Jalal. Nicole is a senior legislative counsel from the Chicago Office of the Uniform Law Commission. And what this bill does is that it creates a platform for the state to publish electronic legal materials in such a way that the users of the materials will be able to authenticate those materials, and also provides a framework for states to preserve legal materials electronically in perpetuity. It's easy if you're using the ORS, you turn around one of those brown volumes, or maybe the West publication, and they're really kind of self-authenticating. If you grab some of these things off the web, you don't know that the version you're looking at on the web is an official version, or you may assume that, but it's difficult to authenticate. This bill creates, again, the technological platform for the Secretary of State's office with regard to administrative rules and the Legislative Council with regard to statutes to authenticate what these legal materials are electronically. So in the future, again, as we move more and more into the digital world where these things will be available, they will be as easy to authenticate as pulling a statute off of the bookshelf in the brown-bound volume of the ORS. So that's what I bring you. Tom was, no, he's gone. Told me he liked this bill,
You're
too.
You're on your own.
Yeah, Tom told me he liked this bill, too. He worked with the American Association of Law Libraries in sort of a precursor effort here. And as you can see, this is supported by the Association of Law Libraries, as well as advisors from the ABA and the two largest national publishers of legal materials, LexisNexis and Thomson Reuters. And so it's a broad consensus product at the national level. And again, there's no opposition in the House, and I think this will serve Oregon well in the years to come.
So I noticed on the registration form for witnesses, you took the second slot, hoping someone would fill in the first one.
Mr. Chair, I sort of expected that one of the representatives who sponsored this might wander down here and tell you why you should pass their bill, but I'm happy to do it for them.
We have questions over here.
I'm a little concerned. I had a number of questions that I wanted to address to the sponsors, and they're not here, so I'm wondering if we should hold it over.
Should we hold it over?
Hold it over until we get some of them here.
We can do that.
Yeah, that'd be good. All right. I'd love to talk to Barton and Davis about
it. All right. So, any other, Senator Dingfelder, did you have any other comments besides?
I actually had a question.
Oh.
A real question. Thank you.
Yeah, real question. Senator Roblin's on. We haven't heard of him.
I offered my time. I wasn't going to pick on this person.
Oh, this isn't picking on, but thank you. I think this is an excellent idea, and I said it's sort of amazing that we don't have it already, but this is, I would call, the geeky lawyer.
Right.
Bill. Was there a discussion about the fact that right now, for instance, I think legislators still get bound copies delivered, and I'm more than happy to give up my copies knowing that I can just get online and make sure I have authentic statute references and such. Was there discussion about, you know, cost savings for the state, or was there a revenue impact on this? I mean, I would think that it would be a cost saving overall if we're reducing the number of.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Dingfelder, again, since this didn't go through a work group process, there's really no discussion of it per se, and none in the House committee. I think it really is up to the users of the materials whether or not to convert as we go to exclusively electronic, and I think it's true as they do, there'll be significant cost savings down the road, but certainly not in the biennium, and so I don't think there was any particular impact one way or the other attached to this bill.
Anyway, thanks a good bill, and thanks for bringing it forward or being the convener.
We'll see if anyone snuck into the room or is laying low. Is there anyone else here who wants to testify on House Bill 2944?
You think they'd all be running over here at this point, but.
Thank you. I guess this is one of the questions I was thinking of. I look at it, and there's a lot of deals that say you have to prove that it wasn't approved by a predominant preponderance of the evidence that the record is not authentic. I mean, I get very confused, and we've had a really difficult time at the high school with our librarians over the last number of years making sure that some of these websites that produce stuff are really authentic.
And right.
We came up with a way to codify that so that our students did a better job of being able to authenticate where they got the sources from. But the internet is exceptionally good at making materials that look very good that aren't. Mm-hmm. And I guess, does this really give us a sense that if the certain things are done, we will know for certain that they are?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roblin, I guess the bill can't solve all aspects of internet fraud and abuse, but it does, again, as I said, create a framework for the state to work with their platform provider, internet service providers, and others to create this is way beyond my expertise, but it authorizes them to create this methodology to authenticate. And I think in doing that, I assume that they take into account how inauthentic records are represented as authentic and build ways around that. I think, like everything else on the internet, it's probably an iterative process, and as you fix one problem, then somebody else comes up with a way to create another one, and you fix that. But this, again, what it does is create the framework for the state for the publishers to work with these electronic materials in such a way that those who use them will have confidence that they are, in fact, authentic.
Okay. Anything else?
No.
All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2944. We are going to schedule this for this Thursday and allow for the representatives who are the sponsors to be able to come and tell us why this
important.
Should be moving forward.
Yeah.
All right, so with that one, we close that. We're going to open up our public hearing. Lane, thank you very much for being here today.
Sure.
House Bill 3047A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3047A is a response to the Richardson versus ODOT case. This allows the court to direct the Department of Motor Vehicles to suspend and resuspend a license for a person who fails to pay fines, makes changes under both failure to comply statute and failure to appear statutes, extends the time period for a court to notify DMV of suspension from 10 to 20 years from the date of offense, declares emergency effective on passage. I believe we do have an amendment expected on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. I've got a number of people that are scheduled to testify. I'm going to bring up a panel of Carl Myers, Dave Factor, and Cheryl Stone. So whoever wants to be first can give us their name and give us their testimony.
Go ahead. I'm going to lead off. Go ahead. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Factor. I work with the Oregon Judicial Department in the Office of the State Court Administrator. Pleased to testify this morning in support of this bill, along with representatives from municipal and justice courts, and as well as the Oregon Department of Transportation. This bill is an effort to restore a practice common in all of our courts for many years that changed when the Department of Motor Vehicles advised courts in January of this year that they would no longer follow that practice based on their interpretation of the Court of Appeals opinion in Richardson versus the Oregon Department of Transportation. Richardson was a case where someone had been suspended for failure to pay fines on numerous occasions, and historically courts have offered someone the opportunity to get on a payment schedule and pay their fines and then reinstate their license, and that could happen multiple times during the course of a suspension period. The Richardson opinion said that you can't suspend someone beyond the maximum length of their suspension even if they hadn't paid their fines yet. You had that outside limit. Our reading of it was that it didn't really do anything inside of that 10 years, but the Department of Motor Vehicles issued a notice to courts in January saying that they you could only engage in that suspend and reinstate process one time during the life of the suspension. So we think that that's eliminated a useful tool for courts to collect and enforce judgments and collect fees and fines that are owed to the state. This bill affirmatively restores that practice. We worked with Representative Olson and Amy Joyce representing the Oregon Department of Transportation. I think we've come to a mutually agreed upon resolution to this so that we can continue that practice.
All right, thank you. Who's next?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Carl Myers. I am the presiding judge in the city of Kaiser, also the presiding judge in the city of Jefferson. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Municipal Judges Association and the Oregon Justices of the Peace Association. This bill is very critical for the way we manage particularly our traffic courts and attempt to collect fines, judgments that are due for traffic violations. It has been my practice in both my cities that if somebody has a large judgment, they've skipped out or whatever, they have a large judgment, they want to get their license back. If they pay half down, half of what they owe, I'll give them their license back as long as they enter into and stick with a payment plan for the balance. This is part of my carrot and stick approach to to handling these folks. Most of those people actually carry through, but on occasion we will have a person who's got their license back again who will then stop making payments. Prior to this, I would just issue another, prior to the Richardson case and the DMV memo, I would just issue another suspension of their license and get their attention again. Now I cannot do that. The first time I suspend, when I reinstate, I've lost the ability under the DMV memo to resuspend. And so we've taken away the stick at the back end of these situations. It is very important for us to be able to have that stick at the back end so that we can encourage people to meet their obligations, be responsible, pay off their fines, and learn from the conviction that there are penalties and they can't just skate on the judgments owing to these various jurisdictions. I might also point out that part of the traffic fines that we collect our payments to the state, so it, our ability to collect on these judgments more effectively will also increase the monies going to the state, not only to the local jurisdictions and the courts that collect them. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, Cheryl.
Sure. Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Cheryl Stone, I am the municipal court administrator at the City of Eugene Municipal Court. Here on behalf of the City of Eugene, City of Eugene supports House Bill 3047, and I will just echo the comments that have already been made. This bill allows the court to work with the community to get licensed drivers back on the road when they are willing to comply with the court orders and make their payments. So there's two benefits, I believe, to this bill. One is that it gives a tool to the courts to be able to collect the fine, which is the sanction for the offense that was committed, and secondly, to get licensed drivers back on the road so we have less people driving while suspended in our communities. There was a recommendation to amend the bill to change the date from the time that suspension is measured. In the bill, it says the offense date. Our recommendation was to move that to the conviction date. There can be a gap in those dates, more significant in misdemeanor crimes than violations. We are okay with the bill as it stands. There is no need for an amendment.
All right, so I'm going to go ahead and start off with the questions, though. So this is clarification. So right now, the way it's written is based on offense. So in the sense of when they're convicted, the suspension would date back to the offense date versus the date of conviction?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That was at the request of the Department of Motor Vehicles. It's easier for them to program. Their representative is in the audience and may be able to better address that. From our point of view, from the court's point of view, the date of conviction is an easier date to work with. But in as much as DMV is the one that has to administer these and gets in trouble, I guess, if they don't administer them correctly, I'm happy to go with the DMV recommendation. I will
just say right now, I'm just going to cut through this. I'm not. I think that basically, and Amy can come up and you can convince me and the rest of the committee, fine. But at this point, you can actually have someone not actually come to court on a timely basis, and what I'm hearing is that you're going to date back to the offense date, and so they could basically be driving for 3 or 4 months.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we did discuss that prior to the hearing. In traffic matters, it doesn't matter so much because if they miss their first appearance date, they are guilty by default and a judge's judgment is entered then, so there may only be a gap of 30 days.
Okay, I'm comfortable with that. I was thinking crimes.
Well, in crimes, it can be a problem, but in many cases, the more expensive, the higher the crime, you don't collect on those judgments, those fines much anyway.
Okay.
Yeah. My question is, as I read it, may I have it wrong? It used to be the ruling has been by ODOT or whoever that you've only got, if it's a 10-year suspension, you've only got that 10 years to do this, and that what happened was you lost the ability to go back in that 10-year period and take away the license.
Resuspend.
Resuspend.
Correct.
This one also extends it to 20 years?
Correct.
So now you've done two things. One, you're reinstating what you used to be able to do in that 10-year period, but you've also extended the period of time in which you could continue to collect from 10 to 20. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
Senator Prozanski, Senator Robum, yes, that's correct. That does match the life of the judgment. The judgment is in effect for 20 years. It's just under the current law, we couldn't collect after the, or we couldn't suspend after the first 10. We could collect, but it's very difficult to collect if you don't get their attention.
Okay.
Senator Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave, what is the cost? How many tickets does a person have to have before their license is suspended?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Close, there are a number of triggers to get a license suspended. So it's not a number of offenses. Under DMV rules, if you have a certain number of offenses in a short period of time, your license will either be restricted or suspended, depending on whether it's the second or third within that period of time. You can have your license suspended for failing to provide proof of insurance. You can have your license suspended for failing to pay child support. You can have your license suspended for committing certain acts that while driving that by statute require your license be suspended for a period of time.
And you can give multiple tickets at one traffic stop, correct?
Correct.
Let's put a clarification here. I think Senator Close doesn't understand at this point. What we're talking about are court suspensions based on actions that the individual's been required to do and they failed to do it.
I understand, but because they give multiple tickets, especially on young people, the tickets pile up, they lose their license, there's a charge to reinstate, so now you're into hundreds and hundreds of dollars, and it creates a financial burden. And I understand you need to collect your fines, but I had a constituent was at a railroad crossing. The red lights went on. People braked. He couldn't stop in time. Rear-ended the car in front of him, so he got reckless driving, failure to obey the device. Then he had one other speeding ticket, so you know you lose your license. So the problem is you're piling on fine after fine, and it becomes a burden.
Chair Prozanski, Senator Close, those are not suspendable through the court. Those are DMV suspensions, administrative suspensions for that. It was my understanding that if they haven't, they were looking at changing so that if you got three tickets in the same incident, that would not count as the three tickets. I can't answer that. We did suggest that at one point in a work group working with DMV. But those are not suspensions that come from the court. The suspensions we're talking about are failing to pay fines.
But if that person does not pay the fine to DMV, will not they end up in your court then? That's the question.
Pay to the court. These are court
the fines are due to the court, Senator Close, and if they do not pay them with us or work out a payment plan to pay off the fine, then yes, they can be suspended. If they fail to make a payment under the payment plan without permission from the court, they can be held. It's failure to comply is the statute. They're failing to comply with a court order to pay a judgment or to do something else as part of the judgment, such as attend a class or whatever.
Fines, correct.
Yeah, but what happens is most of the courts will have a payment plan. The courts I'm familiar with will have a minimum base fine of, let's say, $25. And so if they have a $600 obligation of the court, they would be obligated if they get the lowest part of $25 per month. As long as they're paying their $25 a month, then they're fine. But if they stop making those payments, depending on how quickly the court reacts, it may be two payments out. Then they'll basically get someone in and say, what's going on? And what they're supposed to do is write a letter to the judge and say, hey, I can't pay this month because something's happened. And a lot of times they'll just waive it for that month. But the other one I think I'd mention to you based on your constituent, the reckless driving, now that is a statutory suspension of the license of 90 days and on their first offense for reckless driving could be a year if it was second or subsequent. So there's multiple different types of suspensions, but the ones they're talking about is where someone's come before the court or failed to come before the court and failed to comply with the court order.
I understand, but my point is, because of the multiple costs, if you have a college student who has a part-time job, their license is suspended, to get it back, they have to pay, I believe, around $100 to reinstate. They don't have that kind of money, so they don't pay multiple fines, and then they get into trouble with the court because of the punitiveness on the other side. You know, why does it take $100 to reinstate a license at DMV? I don't know. Then their insurance goes up. So now you're upwards of $1,000 on a kid that doesn't even have a full-time job. I've seen this happen.
Chair Przanski and Senator Close, one of the conversations we had with City Council in City of Eugene was that this tool actually helps solve for that problem, because otherwise a court will suspend somebody's license and there's no avenue for the court to reinstate that person when they want to become compliant. And so their license will remain suspended until they've paid off the whole $600 in the example Senator Przanski gave. So with this tool, we are able to reinstate their license at the point that they can start making payments, or offer them whatever other options the court might offer in terms of a payment agreement. And as long as they're compliant with that and in communication with the court, we can continue to have their license reinstated and only resuspend them if they fail to comply at a later point. If they had come to their court date that they were given on their citation and made payment arrangements right up front, they would never get into a suspended status to start with for a failure to comply with a court order.
I understand, but they would for not paying the fine to DMV, correct? And it starts them down this road of...
They're not paying to the DMV.
Senator Przanski, Senator Close, the fine amount that's imposed by the court is paid to the court, not to the DMV. I think
correct.
Maybe what you're referring to is the $75 reinstatement cost. Once somebody is suspended, there is a reinstatement fee paid at DMV. We at the court can still clear their suspension on our end, but in order to fully reinstate their license, they do have to pay that reinstatement fee to DMV.
I understand. I'm just saying the whole process of going through this for a lot of young people is there's cost at DMV, there's cost to the court, there's cost to their insurance. You know, it's all separate, but it all adds up for that driver. And I believe that's why they get in this position where they can no longer, because they have to get to work, so then they have to pay more to get a license that allows them to drive to work. I believe that's another $80. And it goes on and on and on. So, anyway, thank you.
All right. Any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much. Amy, while she's coming up, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on 74A?
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation representing the DMV. The previous panel did a pretty good job, you know, outlining the situation here, and maybe I can just address a couple of the issues that came up during questioning. In terms of using date of incident as opposed to the date of conviction, that decision has to do with where to begin the calculation of the 20 years, not when the suspension begins. So, you know, whether you're talking about 30 days or even a year between incident and conviction, you're still talking about how long that 20 years runs, so you've really got a date certain. The suspension under this provision would never go into effect until a person had a fine owed to the court, so after the conviction happens, and then failure to pay, so the suspension would never begin to run until after that had happened. And again, this is only for the type of suspension that is for failure to pay fines to the court. Court notifies DMV, and it's used as a, you know, carrot or stick for the courts to collect their money. So that's the only kind of suspension we're talking about under this bill. And lastly, there again, the parties are working on an amendment to sort of clarify the applicability paragraph at the end of the A. Engross bill is woefully complex to the point that I, you know, despite having a law degree, can barely understand what it's supposed to be doing. So for the sake of clarity and consistency and et cetera, working on an amendment to make it very clear, you know, to whom this will apply and at what point.
All right, so let's get clarification about the amendment. So this is a separate amendment from what we were talking about previously, is for clarification So who's working on the amendment now?
Chair Prusansky, I worked with the proponents, Judge Meyer and Judge Lemhouse and Mr. Factor, earlier last week, and cleared it with Representative Olson, the sponsor of the bill, and also involved Council Brown.
Right, so you're on top of it?
Yes.
All right. That's all I need to know. All right. Any other questions or comments?
Could I get the actual fees down, what they are now?
Amy, if you know what the fees are for DMV, if someone has their license suspended by the court and then they want to reinstate with the DMV, mm-hmm. what are the costs for...
Chair Prusansky and Senator Close, regardless of the reason for reinstatement after suspension, it's a $75 fee.
Okay, and the driving while suspended is, what is the fee for that?
That is a fine that's entered by the court. There's a base fine, which we can find out what the minimum is.
No, I'm talking about being able to drive to work. You have to file for that driving while suspended permit. What is the
Chair,
cost of that?
Chair Prusansky and Senator Close, are you speaking perhaps about a hardship permit that you get while
yes.
you are suspended?
So you can go to work.
Well, I can find that out, but I believe that a hardship permit is not available on a failure to comply suspension.
I understand, but I'm talking about before they've paid their fine, but they have three tickets, so now they're suspended, so now they have to get the hardship permit. I believe it's $80.
Chair Prusansky and Senator Close, I'll check. If their choice okay. is that they want to get a hardship as opposed to reinstate, I'll check on the fee for a hardship permit.
Well, they can't reinstate because they're suspended for an amount of time with you, correct?
Chair Prusansky and Senator Close, if we're talking just about suspensions, not about this bill?
Correct.
Right. I'm trying to add up the cost of this person, why they may not be able to pay the fine with the court because of the added cost through your department.
Chair Prusansky and Senator Close, perhaps I can meet with you offline and determine...
Why don't you just tell me the cost of the hardship permit?
Senator Close, I don't know offhand. I will check and get back to you.
That's the problem. Thank you.
All righty. Thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3047A. Open our work session on House Bill 3047A. Senator Dingfelder.
Okay, I thought there was an amendment.
Close the work session.
I know that was just a test to make sure we were paying attention.
Well, it is Monday. Okay. All right, anything else that we need to work on today?
Nope.
All right, so council for tomorrow did not post a schedule. So we are not having a meeting tomorrow, in the way I understand it, and we'll be here on Wednesday at 8:30. So that is what word got to me on Friday afternoon, is that Mike did not put anything up, so we will not be meeting tomorrow, but we will be here on Wednesday.
We'll just have a busier day on Wednesday.
All right, with that, thank you very much, and we're adjourned.
There's two bills on Wednesday, so you're fine.